Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Founders Grid, sponsored by Gaper.io. Today we have Daniel from Sherp Travel. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So can you tell us a bit about yourself, your background before Sherp Travel?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was born in South Africa, grew up there, and then kind of at university age started bouncing around to Europe and back. We'd study for a little bit in South Africa, go over to London, work in bars and such, and then bring back pounds to pay off my student loan. So it took me a while to get my degree, but I didn't, you know, tally up huge amounts of student loan. And I met a American woman in London, and roundabout way ended up moving to the States. And, you know, initially wanted to be a teacher, English teacher in particular. And that led me into studying more English and writing towards copywriting, technical writing, project management. And I ended up in the technology world just through kind of following my interests, you know, starting with the English language as a teacher and ending up as a copywriter in a marketing agency, essentially. And after working in Seattle, you know, project managing some tech teams, design teams and such, my wife was got pregnant. We moved to Austin, Texas from Seattle. And then I sort of started my startup journey. I worked at a big real estate firm for the first, I guess, 2 years moving here. But, you know, I missed the writing part, kind of, you know, writing really was my passion. And so I started doing some freelance journalism, I guess. Journalism is probably a strong word. But, I started writing and actually covering South by Southwest and some technology. And at some point, I interviewed a couple founders who were not technical. And I got inspired by that. I had an idea for a startup in the music space and went to them and said, you know, how exactly do you start a tech startup without knowing how to write code? And they pointed me in the right direction. And kind of meet up some books and blogs and such. And I've been in the startup space now for about 8 years. I founded a music tech company that was music photography, so kind of Instagram for concerts, pre-Instagram, and lots of fun, lots of free concerts and such, but difficult to monetize, and lots of lessons learned there. And then moved to a travel tech company that was doing a lot of data normalization, bringing in air and hotel content that's not typically available. And after that, I kind of came out of that and founded Sherp.
Okay, interesting. Interesting journey from being an English teacher to a technology founder. What led you actually to form Sherp Travel? You know, you've been at it 3.5 years now. So what actually led you to it, and how's the journey been so far?
Yeah, it was kind of funny. I mean, you know, the startup ups and downs can be, can be challenging on yourself, your bank account, relationships and such sometimes, you know. So I got to the point where, you know, after my second startup, which is still going, but I thought I needed a break. I was like, I just want a job with a health benefits and dental insurance and 401k matching. You know, I've done the startup thing. I think I want to just have a couple years of stability. And what I found was that everyone I went to sort of told me I needed to start a company. So, you know, I went to a recruiter who had found me employees in the last company where I was chief product officer. I wasn't a founder there, but, you know, he'd found me my two top engineers and a few other people. And so I went to him and said, hey, I need you to find me a job. And he told me, well, you know, everyone that's worked for you has come to me after you left and said they want to work for you again, or they want to work with you again. So I don't want to find you a job. I think you need to start a company and I want to keep recruiting for you. So, and I had a few meetings like that. I went to some mentors and advisors of mine, and they all sort of said, look, you've learned a lot, you've grown a lot. you know, you kind of, this is the time you want to do a startup. You're primed. You've made your early mistakes. You've kind of, you've been open to learning. So go again. So, and then I had a fund in Austin, Capital Factory, which is an accelerator and fund, you know, made me an entrepreneur in residence. And at about the same time, you know, those two lead engineers from the last company came and said they wanted to work with me again. So essentially, I ended up with technical co-founders and some funding before I had a product idea, which is, I do recognize, a very privileged position, but it did, you know, kind of come on the heels of 6 years of networking, struggling, showing resilience, you know, in these other startups. And, you know, I sat down with my two co-founders, Ray and Rafael, and we just sort of looked at the landscape and decided we wanted to stay in the travel space because we had built up a good network and I'd gotten to know a lot of people in the industry and investors and such in the space. And that's kind of where we came up with the idea. And, you know, for Shep, and funnily enough, we actually, instead of doing a to-do list, we kind of made a to-don't list, a list of things we didn't want to do, and came up with a unique product. And so we essentially looked at the travel industry, having been at the prior company where we built a online booking tool. And I said, look, I don't want to take payment. There's a lot of fraud in travel. I don't want to pick up the phone and do servicing of trips and changes and cancellations. You know, we don't want to ingest content and GDS content and you know, do all that. So we kind of made a list of things that were really difficult in the travel industry, but were kind of what everyone else was doing. And that's really where we kind of came up with the idea for Shep.
Okay. The list of don'ts, you know, that's the time I've actually heard about it. So, yeah, pretty interesting, pretty interesting. So, and in regards to your, you've closed a couple of rounds, I believe. So, can you guide the users or share the experience, the first round and the second one? How was it, you know, being from one side of the table to another, getting grilled? You know, sometimes when you're getting grilled, you go like, you know, I'll do it on my own, you know. So,
Totally. So I think, you know, so for some context, what we are is a browser extension for business travel. And, you know, if you work at a big company, typically employees are meant to book in a single place. The big tool is called Concur that employees have to book on. And, you know, about 30% of the time, employees don't. They'll go and they'll book on, you know, directly on a supplier site like Hilton, or they'll go to Airbnb, or a book on an OTA like Expedia. And so that becomes a blind spot for companies. So we figured a browser extension could guide policy, pop-up messages, and capture data so that the travelers, even when they're booking where they shouldn't, can either be redirected back in or they can be advised, you know, at the right time. So that's kind of where the product is very kind of niche, data capture and messaging for corporate travel. And so we sort of didn't go big and broad with our first investors. You know, I knew that trying to explain that landscape and all these kind of interconnected rings of complexity in the corporate travel space was going to be fairly difficult for an average angel investor, let's say, without that background. Excuse me. So I did have the sort of like initial backing from Capital Factory, you know, as a committed investor, but it allowed me to then go to my network that I'd built up in the travel industry from the last company. And, you know, people are, if you ask and you're pretty clear about your intentions, people are typically willing to make introductions. And if you go and say, hey, I need someone to help me validate this idea, and not say, I need someone to just fund me to, you know, make stuff up and see if it works, you know, people will say, oh yeah, you should definitely talk to this person. So my first couple of investors, angel investors, were the first one was someone who'd invested in my first company. I went back to him and said, look, I learned all this lesson and lost your money. I would hate for this company to be successful and you paid the price for my learnings. So I'm not asking you for money, but if you are interested, you know, I would love to be able to make back what I lost in the first startup. So he came in, and then the next three investors were all from the travel industry through introductions. And so the first person was the former president of Travelocity Business. And I basically went to her and said, do you think this will work? Is this, you know the corporate travel landscape is a completely different approach, which is guiding behavior with an extension when everyone else is building standalone sites. We can guide behavior across, 70 sites. Do you think that's compelling and interesting? And she said, yes, it is. I know the space. I've spent decades in it. And let me introduce you to someone else who knows the space well. And so my one strategic angel investor, who's now a board member, introduced me to several other travel industry angels. And by the time, you rack up four people who know the space, who kind of validate that your approach is unique and interesting and have put their money behind it, then you can start talking to your average angel investor and say, look, it is early, we're pre-revenue, but these people who know a thing or two about the space invest. And that kind of gets over that initial hurdle of believability when it's in an industry that someone might not know about. And so that was kind of our first round, was a few angels. We then had a fund come in called Moonshots Capital that is sort of focused on mobility, transport, and veteran-led companies. And we don't have any veterans in our company, but they sort of liked what they saw, liked the transport and data, angle of what we were doing. And they came in, and then we just, and peppered in a few angels here and there along the way, and just closed a strategic investment from a large corporate travel agency on New Year's Eve of 2019. So, and then they're a group called Flight Center. So that's our funding history.
Well, that's amazing. Congratulations on the new partnership, the raising of investments. So going forward, how do you see the OTA space evolving? We've been seeing consolidators, integrators being added for the last 10 to 15 years, actually, even more. But in the last couple of years, the things have started evolving in the OTA space and it needs to be redone. So how do you see it going forward?
Yeah, so for those who don't know, OTA is an online travel agency, so like Expedia or, Hotwire, hotels.com. I can get super nerdy about this. I think that there's definitely some interesting challenges ahead because the supplier sites, so the Hiltons and American Airlines and Deltas that, they would obviously rather have you book directly on their website because they can offer an upsell. They can try and get you into their loyal program. They can, try and get you to pay more for extra leg space and all that stuff. And so if you book directly on Delta, they can do that at that point. Whereas if you book on Expedia, it's only when you check in just before your flight that they have the opportunity to do some of that stuff. So there's definitely some tension between the direct suppliers and the OTAs, who are kind of the resellers. So much so that Lufthansa, for example, will actually charge a traveler an additional fee, which is like a distribution fee, if you don't book directly on Lufthansa. So like some of the supplier sites are really taking a stand and saying, don't book outside of us. Obviously, The business travel space is interesting because I've got I've interacted with travel managers of large kind of Fortune 500 companies, and some will say, well, if my employee is not going to book in Concur, as long as they book on our preferred supplier and use our corporate rate, then I'm fine with that. So as long as they go to Hilton and then put in our corporate code, they can do that. And then there's others who say, no, I want them to go to an OTA, because the OTA allows them to compare and see what the, you know, the Delta versus the American versus the United fares are. So I know they're getting the best price because they've done comparison searching. So there doesn't seem to be a super uniform perspective on that from the business travel side. Obviously, everyone would prefer you book in their booking tool because then they have all the controls and everything. But the OTAs definitely are in a bit of a tug of war with the suppliers directly. And I think the suppliers are learning and evolving more and more and getting smarter about how they get direct bookings. And there's some cool stuff coming up. There's a thing called NDC, which is a new distribution capability that would allow the airlines to actually offer some of those upsells, cross-sells, extra leg room, kosher meals and such through the OTAs. So the content will get richer, which would make everyone happy. It allows those upsells, it gets the, you know, the OTAs are able to sell more complicated package deals and such. So that could make things a lot better for everyone, where it kind of becomes a bit of a win-win. The challenge for the OTAs is they have to then integrate the content supplier by supplier instead of just connecting to the mainstream, you know, fire hose of the what's called the GDS, which is the global distribution system.
Yeah.
Again, as I said, probably over everyone's head and too nerdy for, but yeah, but it's an interesting evolving space. There's very old legacy technology that the GDS that distributes the content. And there's a lot of moves to see, can it be changed, displaced, updated, that affects everyone in the ecosystem.
Interesting. So lastly, just in order to wind it down, any piece of advice that you would give to young entrepreneurs that are coming out there, and something, one question that is I ask everyone, what do you see about the remote employment, and do you see that on the rise?
Yeah, so from an advice perspective, I would say do your research, know what's come before you, what's failed, what has succeeded, because you know, I'm a mentor at a few accelerators, and I'm always surprised when someone comes up with an idea. And it's something that, you know, as someone who goes to travel conferences, for example, I've seen the same idea pitched, you know, 15 times. And I'm always surprised when someone has an idea and thinks just because they haven't seen it come across their computer screen in the last 2 months, that it's never existed and never been tried, because there's a lot to be learned from prior successes and failures. So I'd really say that industry research is very important, and getting advisors who've been in the space is pretty critical. One of my favorite sayings is, you know, make original mistakes. So, you know, making mistakes is just part of the journey. It's expected, but, you know, you want to see what's happened before so you can make your own mistakes. You're not just making the same ones. As for the remote working, you know, we've built our company to be fully remote. We don't have a physical office. You know, my team works when is best for them. You know, I'm a very early riser. I like to get up early, work out, get my emails done, and start the day with a fairly clean inbox and all that stuff. And then, you know, some of my engineers work late into the night. They're more effective there. And if you're not constrained to, you know, keeping people within an hour commute of your office, that means you can find amazing talent almost anywhere in the world, you know, who aren't unable to travel or don't want to live in the big city, or, you know, maybe are at home because of kids or, you know, whatever circumstances. And there's very talented people everywhere. So the rise of chat tools and, you know, instant messaging, video conferencing. And then I think in the, you know, mid future, I think AR and VR, you know, allow for, you know, giving more of a sense of presence. So it's one thing to sort of be on a conference call and I don't know, are you paying attention? Are you looking down at your phone while I'm talking? But I think when we do move towards maybe a little more AR, I think that the video conferencing and working remote gets even better and even stronger.
That's interesting. Moving forward. Thank you so much, Daniel, for taking the time out. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.